This is the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. I have the pleasure of chatting today with Mr. Harry Dent. Harry is a best-selling business author. His recent book, The Demographic Cliff, How to Survive and Prosper During the Great Deflation of 2014 to 2019, is available. I'd encourage you to check it out. He's also the editor of the free newsletter, Economy and Markets. And Harry, we were chatting a bit about, in the last segment, about your forecast for stocks, which I don't know if the word dismal is the word you used, but I'll use it if that's fair. Let me ask you, if you go back and take a look at the tech stock bubble collapse that occurred in 2001, and the financial crisis occurred in 2007 to 2009, you talked about the fact that there's always a trigger that starts these events. What's it going to be this time?
Well, I think the markets are really underestimating this drop in energy, oil prices, and the fracking bubble. People, we've been told now for years that the U.S. has a whole revolution in energy. It's leading. It's going to make us self-sufficient and exporters. This is a total bunk. This fracking bubble is a bubble industry. The Fed, by pushing long-term Treasury rates down under 2%, junk bonds that are used to finance this risky drilling used to be 8 to 10%. Now they're 5 to 5.5%. Up until recently, this cheap financing has made these companies profitable. The second thing, oil prices, if you remember, dropped from $147 to $32 in 4.5 months in 2008, the fastest bubble burst I have ever seen anywhere. And only because of the massive stimulus and quantitative easing did the economy bounce back and oil got back above $100 a barrel. But it didn't stay there. We've been warning people that was a long-term peak. Oil is ultimately going to $10 to $20 a barrel and certainly back to the 2008 lows of $32. And this makes all these frackers, they need $55 to $80 to make it, to break even. So there's going to be no more fracking drilling. A lot of these companies are going to default on their debt, and they've been a huge employment surge, especially for Texas and North Dakota, a million jobs created or more. So I think this is the trigger, and people say, well, that's not that big. Well, all it took to trigger the 2008 worldwide financial crisis and Great Recession was four states having a subprime mortgage crisis. All four states, California, Nevada, Arizona, Florida, were the crux of that. Four states triggered the whole world. And the only reason, as we show in the book, we have a whole chapter that shows debt around the world. We have unprecedented debts, unprecedented unfunded entitlements by governments for retirement and health care and things like that. And all it takes is something to go wrong for people to start worrying about all this debt. And then the more the debt defaults, the more other debts default, and you just get a chain reaction, and that's what happened in 2008. So I think that is the beginning. Commodity prices are collapsing. It's not just oil around the world. That hurts emerging countries, and a lot of emerging country companies borrow money from U.S. banks or in U.S. dollar-denominated loans and bonds, and those are going to keep defaulting. So we just get defaults, and the biggest default is going to be the China bubble. Mark my words, Dennis, on this. The China bubble is the greatest real estate bubble in history. It is starting to crack. When it does, it's going to absolutely annihilate wealth in China. Chinese save way more than we do, and they put 75% of it in real estate. We only put like 28%. So this is going to be a huge blow to China, and that's the last domino to fall. Singapore is already cracking. It's the most expensive city in the world. It's so expensive from foreign buyers that the government has had now slapped huge taxes on foreign buyers, and that demand's drying up, and the Singapore market's going to be crashing, already down 5%, but it's going to be crashing by next year. So plenty of things to trigger this, and yet, the Fed's saying, oh, this isn't a bubble, everything's okay, and stock investors think there's no chance we could have more than a 10 or 20% correction. They are going to be wrong about this.
So, Harry, you talk about the fracking bubble. That was a great explanation. To what extent is this bubble driven by demographics, or is it more driven by monetary policy?
No, that was total monetary policy. That bubble would have never happened without zero interest rates. What the Fed has basically done, Dennis, if you want to get simple about it, they've set short-term interest rates to zero, which they can do by decree. That's the lowest they've ever been. That's crazy. It's free money. But with quantitative easing, which is unprecedented, they've never done this outside of World War II to any extent, they've just printed money out of thin air to buy Treasury and other long-term bonds to push down long-term rates. Now you've got Treasury bonds, 10-year Treasury bonds, it plus or minus 2% with 2% average inflation in recent years. That is zero interest rate adjusted for inflation long term. So we've got zero interest rates. When you get zero interest rates, investors will speculate. This fracking bubble all of a sudden becomes profitable. So you build up these bubbles in assets. Stocks just go up and up and up. And at some point, something's going to go wrong, and then these bubbles are going to burst. The problem with quantitative easing is not that it's going to cause inflation, because the money's not going into lending in the normal things it does. It's just going into speculation. David Stockman calls it the casino economy. So this is the most dangerous bubble we've had. It's not only at new highs for almost all the major markets, but it is totally artificially driven. I mean, at least the tech bubble of the 90s saw super high productivity, super high growth of a new sector. The baby boomers were in their strongest spending phase in the 90s when that happened. Now baby boomers are in a down phase. Debt has got, we've added in the world, $57 trillion more debt, more than we added from 2000 to 2007 in the last bubble. I mean, we've added more debt. The demographics are getting worse and worse. This whole thing is fueled by quantitative easing. And when something goes wrong, this thing is going to crash probably faster and harder than it did last time.
So, Harry, we get a crash. We see the beginnings of this this asset pricing reset. The Fed is going to try to respond. What do you think they'll do, and how effective will it be the next time around?
I think it'll be too late. You know, but I think the economy is going to slow this year. Retail sales have already been surprisingly down. We warned last year that Germany was going to slow down, and they keep slowing more than expected. I think, you know, somewhere like maybe the third quarter, they're going to finally figure out the economy is getting a little too slow. And I think that's going to be too late. They're going to be behind the curve. I mean, they did taper off as of late last year. So I think they will try to respond. But I also think that if we see another crash and another meltdown, or start to see it, I think the American public, I mean, I think everybody's always been thinking in the back of their heads, you know, you don't get something for nothing. And this free money thing is really something for nothing. But the economy's done okay, so people are like, well, maybe it's working. I think if this thing fails, I think the public's going to say, look, no more. You already printed $3.5 trillion, and we printed $11 trillion around the world and dumped it in the economy, and here we are crashing worse than last time. This doesn't work, and you don't get something for nothing. So I think there could be a public revolt. I think the Fed could start later this year, okay, we're going to go back to $1 trillion a year QE, and I think this time people will say, you're going to do the same thing again that just failed.
So, Harry, talk about the deflation you're predicting over the next 5 years, and to what extent will that be attributable to private sector debt, and to what extent will it be attributable to public sector debt?
Well, you know, it'll be almost all private sector debt. Government debt only goes up in a downturn because their tax revenues go down and their social expenses and all this sort of stuff goes up. But the good news is the private debt at the top of the bubble in 2008 was three times the government debt, and now it's two times because the government debt has gone up. But we have about $40 trillion in private debt. And in the Great Depression, more than half of our private debt just disappeared. It got restructured. It failed. So that's good. We're going to get a huge burden taken off, but that destroys money. And like you say, you know, there's trillions and trillions of dollars in financial assets and the stock market and housing, all this stuff, and that's going to devalue. All of this destroys money, and it happens very rapidly, especially that the financial assets break the fastest and then the private debt breaks. Long-term, government debt will go down as a percentage of GDP, but the government debt is the one thing that will not go down. But again, deflation throughout history has always followed bubbles. It's where you see the most extreme stock crashes. 89% in the 1930s was the last great debt and financial asset bubble that burst in the United States. And stocks weren't just down the normal 50 to 70% in a major long-term crisis like in the 1970s and the 73-74 crisis. They're down 80 to 90%. And I think the Dow ultimately, when all of our indicators kind of start to bottom out around the early 2020s, I think you could see 3,000 to 4,000. But I think the next stop, the next crash, is going to take us more like the 6,000. So again, not something to sit through as an investor. You've got to protect your assets. Look, we've had the greatest bubble and boom in modern history. Take your assets off the table. Wait and see if I'm right. And I tell you, I think within a year, you're going to know if I'm right. You don't have to stay out of the market forever, but if we don't see a crash start by early 2016 at the latest, then you know, maybe I'm missing something. But I'm telling you, I've done my homework. And this is a bubble, looks like a bubble, quacks like a bubble. Everybody's saying it's not a bubble. All you got to do is lay the stock market over the 94 to 2000 bubble, and you'll see this is almost identical. Bubbles always burst, no exceptions in history.
So, Harry, we've got about 2 minutes left. What are you advising your newsletter readers to do with their assets?
Well, you know, it's just like in a boom, you know, you have to look at your risk tolerance. For a lot of investors, I would just say be in safe short-term government bonds. Get little or no yield. You're protecting your money, and you think you're not earning money, but every time things go down, from real estate to stocks to gold to oil, anything else, your same amount of money now can buy much more of it. You are gaining purchasing power by holding your money. Now, if somebody wants to take a little more risk, the U.S. dollar, not gold and silver, and I've been arguing this for years, and I've won so many bets on this, gold and silver crashed in late 2008 when the crisis hit. The U.S. dollar went up 27%. The U.S. dollar has been up mostly ever since, and it'll go up, I think, another 30, 40% from here. The U.S. dollar versus other currencies, you can buy an ETF like UUP, or you can buy a dollar bull fund. That should be the safe haven, and you can actually make some money rather than just protecting your money. And then if you want to go another step, you can short things like the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ tech stocks. You can have a small amount of your money short, or you can buy an option to protect your portfolio that'll pay off if we do see this crash. So that's the array of things you could do, but there aren't many options. Only high-quality bonds and the U.S. dollar are going to go up. Everything else is going to go down like 2008. So it's not like you can diversify and say, well, I got some in real estate, and I got some in emerging markets, and some in commodities, and some in stocks. No, that won't work. So you really have to narrow down, but you can still diversify. You could be part short stocks, part long dollar, part short-term high-quality bonds, and have some diversification.
Well, our guest today has been Mr. Harry Dent, best-selling author. His most recent book, The Demographic Cliff, How to Survive and Prosper During the Great Deflation of 2014 to 2019. I'd encourage you to check it out. And you can check out his free newsletter at harrydent.com. Harry, thanks for joining us today.
Okay. Thank you, Dennis.
And thanks to our special guest expert this week, Mr. Harry Dent, for joining us on both podcasts. I've had a lot of requests on the podcast and from podcast listeners to talk about Social Security collection options, different ways that you can collect Social Security. And this is an area where a lot of folks make mistakes. We see it all the time. And yet, these mistakes happen because it's such a complex area. So in this segment, I want to cover just a couple of the more common fundamental strategies when it comes to collecting Social Security benefits. So if you're between the ages of 55 and 65, and you are either collecting Social Security or you've not yet started to collect Social Security, or you know someone that is, you'll probably want to reference this segment and perhaps even get the podcast, which is available at the iTunes Store by simply searching under Everything Financial Radio. Now, as I start this conversation about how to collect Social Security and potentially maximize it for your situation, I need to talk a little bit about some definitions that you're going to need to understand. And the first one is, what is a normal retirement age? Well, a normal retirement age, as far as Social Security is concerned, is the age at which you can collect full benefits. They're called primary insurance benefits, but you can collect your full primary insurance benefit at your normal retirement age. Now, if you were born between 1943 and 1954, your normal retirement age is 66. If you were born 1960 or later, your normal retirement age is 67. If you were born in the interim years from 1955 to 1959, your normal retirement age will increase from 66 and 2 months to 66 and 10 months by 2 months every year. So, for example, the normal retirement age for someone born in 1954 is 66. If you're born in 1955, it's 66 and 2 months. In 1956, it's 66 and 4 months, and so on, until 1960 or later when the normal retirement age is 67. Now, if you draw your Social Security at age 62, which is the earliest point at which you can draw Social Security without being disabled, your normal retirement age benefit, your primary insurance benefit that you would collect at your normal retirement age, is reduced by 25%. So if your normal retirement age is 66 and you want to draw at 62, you're going to get a benefit that's reduced by 25%. If your normal retirement age is 67 and you draw at age 62 rather than waiting until 67, your benefit will be reduced by 30%. Now, interestingly, when you look the other way, when you go in the opposite direction, what if you say, I'm not going to collect my benefits early, but I'm going to collect my benefits later? I'm going to defer collecting my Social Security benefits until some point beyond my normal retirement age. Well, if that's the case, your benefits, the amount that you collect will increase by 0.67% per month or 8% per year. Now, this is simple interest only. This increase is simple interest only. So if your normal retirement age is 66, your age 70 benefit will be 132% of your age 66 benefit. Now, it makes no sense to defer beyond age 70 because your delayed benefit credits expire at age 70. So that's the latest date at which it makes sense for you to defer collecting benefits. So let's walk through a couple examples. Let's take a lady that is 66 years old today. That's her normal retirement age. And she can collect Social Security benefits of about $25,400 a year, a little more than $25,000 a year. If she waits until 67, her benefit will increase from $25,400 to $27,400 roughly. At 68, $29,500. At 69, $31,500. And at 70, $33,500. And obviously, I've rounded those numbers. Now, whenever you do Social Security maximization planning, you have to assume something. I've worked in the financial industry for a long time, and the financial industry likes to work on assumptions. However, let me tell you from my experience that the one thing I've learned about assumptions is that they're almost always wrong. It's difficult to look into the future and know exactly what's going to happen. So for our discussion today, I'm going to assume that this lady will live to exactly age 85. If she lives to age 85, if she started drawing the benefits she could at age 66, which if you think back was about $25,400 a year, by the time she's 85, she would have collected about $508,000. However, if she were to wait to collect benefits until age 70, when she could collect about $33,500 a year, instead of $25,400 a year, so it's about an $8,000 increase, she at age 85 would have collected about $537,000. So she collects almost $30,000 more in terms of real dollars. Now, the other thing you have to think about is, what will the inflation rate be? Because we know, as we've talked about here on the program, the U.S. dollar has lost purchasing power over time. So we have to assume something for an inflation rate, and as I've talked about, we don't believe that the inflation rate in the future will be significant, but certainly dollars will likely not buy more than they buy today. So we have to come up with some inflation rate, and if we were to assume an inflation rate of 3%, meaning that a dollar today is going to be worth 97 cents a year from now, and we just take that and extrapolate it forward, then if you take a look at inflation-adjusted benefits, this lady probably does not want to wait until age 70 to collect, because devaluing dollars by 3% each year would mean that she will likely not collect as much in terms of real purchasing power by waiting to age 70. She'd probably want to wait until age 69 or so in this analysis. So there's a lot of moving parts when you do Social Security benefit planning. But one of the big things that people often miss is the ability of one spouse, if you're married, to collect a free spousal benefit. Let's take the example of a married couple, and let's say that in this married couple, the husband is 61 years old, the wife is 65 years old. Well, that's a perfect age spread for collecting Social Security benefits. Because what can happen is if the lady in this example is collecting Social Security benefits, when the husband reaches age 66, which is his normal retirement age, he can start to collect a free spousal benefit. That spousal benefit is half the benefit his spouse in this example would receive at her normal retirement age. So if she were going to receive $25,000 a year at age 66, he would get $12,500 a year at age 66. Now, why would he want to do this? Well, everybody's situation is different, but one of the reasons that you would want to consider this is that if you draw a free spousal benefit at your normal retirement age, your primary benefit continues to grow at 8% per year from age 66 to age 70. So in other words, in this example, the husband could collect the free spousal benefit for 4 years from age 66 to 70, so he's still collecting a benefit. And then, because he's collecting a spousal benefit, his primary benefit, based on his earnings history, grows by 32% from age 66 to age 70. And that is a free spousal benefit that's even available if you're divorced. As long as you were married for at least 10 years, you might be able to draw a free spousal benefit on your ex-spouse's earnings history. This can make a significant difference, particularly when you think about the fact that if you're married, your survivor benefit from Social Security is the larger of the two benefits that you and your spouse are collecting. Hope that overview helps a bit. As I close this second podcast of the week, I'd like to once again offer you the opportunity to get an additional free resource, actually several free resources to be accurate. It is our Investor's Discovery Kit that contains the book New Retirement Rules. It contains an educational CD and DVD, as well as a copy of the New Economy magazine. To get your free Investor's Discovery Kit, just visit the website investingapproach.com. The website again is investingapproach.com. We'll be glad to send it out to you right away. That's our second podcast for the week. Thanks for listening.